welcome to episode 8 of the Planning Period Podcast. Thank you all for joining me so far, and to all my new listeners this week, hey! On this week's episode, I interview Allison Keskamaki, and don't worry, I'll butcher that way worse in the episode. She is the Technology Integration Specialist for the Lansing School District in Lansing, Michigan, and also co-host of the Lansing EdTech Podcast. I met Allison at ISTE this year, where her and her co-host, Eric Spicer, presented a session on podcasting, vodcasting, and vlogging. I liked the session a lot, and afterwards I met with them and asked them to join me. I hope to have Eric on in a future episode. If you're interested in the details of their ISTE session, I'll put a link to the show in the show notes to the blog post I wrote summarizing it. Allison and I talked a lot about paradigms, and specifically how many changes in them we need in education. We touch on student-centered learning, student choice, artifact creation, and how even professional development models need to be changed. So, sit back and enjoy this episode of the Planning Period Podcast, my interview of Allison Keskamaki. All right, welcome to this episode of the Planning Period Podcast. I am joined today by Allison Kersminski. Did I get that even close?
No.
Not even. I had it in front of me to look at and make sure I remember, because I did practice it, and then now I'm like totally forgot to put it back in front of me, and I did not have it in front of me at all. So I'm going to let you introduce yourself then, because I don't want to butcher that twice.
No problem. It's Allison Keskamaki.
Yeah, I wasn't even remotely close.
Keskamaki. No, not really.
Keskamaki. All right. So I'm joined by Allison Keskamaki today, and I think I messed it up again. I threw like an extra S in there, didn't I?
You did. Dang
okay. It. Oh, awful. All right, I'll cut all this out so I look good. It's fine. We met at ISTE. I did want to say that. We did meet at ISTE this year, and she and Eric presented a session on their own podcast, which is the Lansing EdTech Podcast, which some of my listeners may have heard of. But in addition to that, she has a day job and everything else, too. So I'm going to go and let you just give me a little introduction to yourself, tell me what it is you do, how long you've been doing it, that kind of stuff.
Sure. So I am a technology integration specialist in the Lansing School District in Lansing, Michigan. I support our district. There are 27 schools. And so K-12, I've been in this position for 3 years. And prior to that, I was a middle school social studies teacher for 4 years.
Well, middle school social studies. I should have asked that ahead of time. That's cool. I feel like I've not had a lot of social studies teachers on my podcast. So that's cool. Fill a gap at the same time.
Perfect.
So again, I did want to say when we're actually recording that I did appreciate your guys' session on podcasting at ISTE. I thought it was great to see someone talking about how to get a podcast started. And just since this is something that interests me, have you noticed that benefit your district at all? Like, what have you noticed as a result of using this as kind of your district platform? And
yeah, so I would say for sure, just having a better awareness of the issues and challenges that teachers are facing, having conversations with them to kind of guide what our episodes are going to look like. There are certain things, you know, within working in a school environment, you just know, like, oh, beginning of the year, we're always going to talk about organization and strategies around technology usage, especially with the younger grades and setting up routines and all that stuff. But you kind of hit like October, November, and it's like, what do you start talking about? So it gave us an opportunity to build some relationships with teachers throughout the district to really kind of understand what those challenges were and things that they were interested in learning more about. And then just in terms of publicity, we are a very large urban district, and the city kind of suffers from a lot of the same problems that large urban centers suffer from. And the press is not always so positive. So having an opportunity and a platform to share the good stuff that's happening has been really neat too. And it's so easy and simple to just tweet out the links and, you know, more and more people are starting to listen to podcasts. So I think this medium is really starting to take off. And I know from our teachers, they've really appreciated the flexibility to be able to just throw it on their phones while they're making copies or whatever. It's been a pretty easy way for them to get some kind of PD on demand versus some of that sit and get stuff, which I'm slowly working to kind of change that culture because we have traditionally done it that way, as I'm sure a lot of districts have. And so teachers end up with this expectation of like, oh, this PD is going to suck. I'm going to come make sure I have all my other stuff to distract me and, you know, I'll sign in and do whatever. So we're trying to change that culture that professional learning isn't just sitting and having someone tell you something. It can be, you know, more of that on-demand stuff like we kind of discussed in our session ISD. So
cool. Yeah. And between your session and a couple others, there was a lot of thought, at least this was my priority going into a new role and being our full-on curriculum resource teacher next year instead of just digital. I'm running all of our PD at our campus. And one of my obsessions is to get away from sit and get. As like, I don't want to do it because I cannot bring myself to sit there and lecture at my teachers for an hour about how important it is to not lecture to their kids.
Right.
That just doesn't make any sense. I can't keep doing that. And so, yeah, podcasts are actually something I'm looking at next year as using as a way to get my teachers' professional development outside so that my face-to-face time is more useful. And that was in combination between your session and one of the other ones I visited that just kind of put all those pieces together for me at ISTE. And so we'll see how that journey goes in the future.
Yeah.
But that's kind of what I'm in the same boat as you. I get that completely of getting away from that set and get PD model because it just doesn't work.
No.
We know it doesn't work with our kids, and yet we think we can do it with our students. So.
Right. I think George Kuros probably said this first, but I'm stealing it. just that, you know, we do the same thing. We lecture to our teachers for an hour and then say, do something completely different. But if they don't ever have that model of what that could look like, how do we expect people to change what they're doing? So just echo that sentiment for sure.
Agreed. Well, I'm going to go right into my first real question here. And I like to hit my guest with a big one right to begin with. So just out the box, what do you think is currently the biggest problem facing education right now?
Oh, Lord.
And I can always cut out think time too. So feel free to think for a second.
Yeah. I think it's around the personalized learning. And I mean that, in that teachers don't really know what that means. We know how to differentiate instruction, and I'm speaking of teachers in my district, not teachers throughout the world. They don't know how to personalize learning, how to give that control to the students, and how to leverage the technology to allow kids to kind of take ownership of their learning. So, and that's kind of tied up with the use of technology and their beliefs on what that should be or what that looks like. It's still very much that old school, don't touch anything until I tell you, and only do these five things and then wait for the next set of directions. And so it's, again, a culture shift of exploring and making instead of listening and just being the receptacle of information, really letting kids take ownership. So I would say that's the biggest problem I see, at least in this district.
And I definitely think that's true. I think in a lot of ways, it might speak to the bigger issue of just the prevalence of buzzwords in education. And so that people they know the buzzwords, but they don't always know what those buzzwords actually mean. You know, does that make any sense? I think that's a lot of times the issue. But let me ask you this. Whose fault is that? It's not the teacher's fault in a lot of ways. In any other business, you would never, I mean, we could make the argument teachers need to go out and learn it for themselves, but in any other business, you wouldn't expect that. You wouldn't just be like, well, you should have learned about this new way to sell things that we never talked about. So in any other business, we wouldn't have that issue. So whose fault is it that we're in that boat?
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's probably mostly the system. Like, there's not necessarily one person to say, but we don't value, we require professional development, but we don't value it. And so what ends up happening is, like we talked about with the sit and get, okay, you need this many hours of professional development. So we're going to give you 1 hour every week after school. And it's not job embedded. Here's another buzzword, right? But there's also not a lot of follow through and expectation. So, you know, for example, if we want to see a higher level of technology integration, so we want to see students creating things with their technology. Don't make a goal be that kids are using three different apps every week. That was literally a goal that a teacher wrote with my help. Like, no. Like, yes, I want your kids to be using the technology, but don't just use it to use it. So there has to be some kind of expectation, but then also support. And that's where the problem is. Like, yeah, we say you have to do all of these things, which, you know, always goes really well when you tell someone they have to do something. But without any support and any modeling of what that looks like and any opportunity to fail. So it's crazy how teachers are so stressed about these evaluations. And so much of it is dependent on student growth. You know, I know they kind of look different everywhere, but at least here it's 50% of their evaluation. So, you know, the teachers are afraid to do something that they don't know because, well, what if, I mean, obviously it's not working because our kids are still failing, but trying something different is very scary. And feeling like you don't have that support or that safety net is also, you know, makes you really hesitant to embrace it. And I think, too, it's partly just personality. There are some teachers, and it's not at all age-related, because there are some, you know, veteran teachers who are hardcore, like, yes, I want to try this. And there are some brand-new teachers who are like, absolutely not. But I do think that there's that perception shift for some people of, I don't want to look stupid. I'm the teacher. I'm supposed to know everything. And that also has to shift. So I don't know. That was a really long rambling answer, but
no, that's perfect. I feel like we're talking about major paradigm shifts in the way education is done. And I know it's not necessarily age related, but I feel like we sometimes say that as a cop out. Cause I've said that plenty of times. Don't get me wrong. When we went 1-to-1, I'd be like, oh, well, it's not age related. One of my best teachers is right on the verge of retirement, an older teacher, and blah, 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 blah. And when I think back, that's actually just an exception to the rule. Like, I kind of feel maybe we say that as a cop out sometimes. But I don't think it's as much age as maybe it's mindset.
Yeah.
And typically that mindset comes with age, of that I've done this a million times. I don't need to change anything. It's working great. And I think teachers sometimes get a blinder in the sense of it's working great, and then they can't actually prove that it's working great. But you will never convince them that it's not actually working great. And I think maybe that's maybe not really a direct response to what you're saying, but it is across the board a paradigm shift that needs to change in some way. But the other thing I think about, though, you mentioned that we need to open it up to being allowed to have failure, kind of talking about letting teachers try things and not succeed. I agree with you. However, my flip side there is when we fail as teachers, we fail 150 kids in an often irreparable kind of way. So how do we build a system that allows us to fail without completely failing all of our kids?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's baby steps and it's incremental. So I'm not saying, you know, tear up everything you've done and do it all brand new. It's maybe taking a look at one unit. I also taught English, and teaching grammar to eighth graders sucks. and it's one of those things, it's so complicated, and you know, there's like philosophical questions, like, does it really matter? Yeah, there are some things you probably should know, like the difference between your and your. Please, people, learn this. But
I don't know. I think only the English teachers of the internet actually care. I think the internet has proven that it doesn't actually matter. And trust me, I was an English teacher. It drives me insane. But
yeah. So, but like, and also just like grammar was something that came really easy to me. So it was often hard to teach it to kids because like, well, and I didn't learn why things were the way they were. It was just like, these are the rules. This is how it goes. So that was something I always struggled with teaching my kids, because it's boring to just teach them the rules and have them memorize it. So I was constantly trying to find ways to make that more engaging and more interesting. So that would be like my suggestion to teachers, is find a unit or a lesson either that your kids struggle with or that you just hate to teach because it's boring or whatever, and Google, try to find something, and then, or reach out to other people and ask, or when you're in a session, about, you know, Google Docs or whatever, instead of just thinking in terms of, well, this is a word processing tool, and so I can only use this to have my kids write letters and papers, you know, trying to think about ways that it could fit into their curriculum and trying one unit or one lesson versus like redoing the whole thing. I think that's an easy way to not completely fail your kids. No, we all have lessons that totally bomb. And like as a middle school teacher, you know, I taught 6 hours. So my first hour kids, thank goodness they were just really resilient kids, because the first time I taught it versus the sixth time I taught it, a lot different. So I think that's one of the nice things about our job as teachers, the opportunity to like always change and improve. But I think being afraid to just to mess up is not really enough of an excuse to not try something new.
I agree. All right. I'm with you. You know, and you talk about the we have six periods kind of thing, 6 hours, and what you do to first period is never what it is by the time you get to the last period of the day. And I used to always call my first period class, I would tell them openly, like, you're my guinea pig class. You're all going to do terribly this year because everything I do is going to stink. It'll get so much better by seventh period, but that's not going to help you at all. I actually started flipping things. So I would rotate my weekly schedule to where, like, I would do one lesson first, second, and third, and then I would do, like, tomorrow's lesson fourth, fifth, sixth, and then I would switch so that sometimes first period got a lesson that actually worked.
Nice. That's smart.
I was like, that was my flip. I was like, I'm just going to try this because I keep doing things that go terribly with first period. So we're going to try something different. The interesting part about that, but just a side note, I know for a fact that there are kids from my first period class, like from 3 years ago, that listen to my podcast regularly. Like specifically my first period class, not so much the other ones, but I know for a fact that many of my first period kids. And I wonder, actually, interestingly, if it's because of how many times I was okay with failing. Did that help me build a better relationship with those kids simply because I wasn't coming at them as the expert on the front of the room? So big paradigm shifts. We need to think about making changes and accepting failure. I'm good with that. And trying new things. I think I agree with you there. The biggest thing is letting people try and being willing to try for teachers. So I'm going to go to my second question, which you may have already touched on a little bit, but we'll move on to it anyways. What in your eyes is something that you're doing, or maybe when you did when you were in the classroom, that you wish other people would try?
That's a good question. Well, actually, something that I've done more now in this role because I have a little bit more flexibility is connecting with other classrooms. I heard a little bit about Mystery Skype when I was still in the classroom and thought it was a cool idea, but just never got around to actually like doing anything about it other than looking at the website. And yeah, this is cool. So in this role, of course you build relationships with certain teachers and know that there are those who are willing to kind of step out of their comfort zone with the Global Read Aloud. So we, have connected with other classrooms through Skype, as well as, you know, we created like Padlets. I would love to get them involved in Twitter, but that's just not happening anytime soon. But that's been something that I really wish more teachers would do for a few reasons. You know, a lot of our students don't have a lot of opportunities to engage with the world outside of their, you know, small area. They don't have the chance to go on vacation anywhere, let alone like overseas or to another state. So they never really see that there are kids out there who are similar to them, but also different from them and their experiences. They don't have any a kind of understanding or awareness of different cultural things just within like states. Like I lived in Hawaii, very different than living in Michigan. You know, so that opportunity for kids to connect with the world is so important. And I wish that they had more opportunity to do that. Not only because they get all that exposure, but they also have a chance to share who they are with people their own age. And that's so much more powerful than writing a blog post for your teacher. When your classmates or kids around the world comment on things so much cooler than just your teacher who you see every day. We used Padlet. We had kids from Australia commenting and asking questions. And we were never able to connect with them just because time difference was crazy. But it was really awesome to see how excited the kids were, especially about reading, because a lot of them are not. This was in like a remedial reading class. And so that was just really powerful too. So that's something I wish more teachers would do, is just find those opportunities to connect outside of their classroom.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's a huge power in, exactly like you said, getting kids to realize there is this like larger world out there. But I also think that's like an absolutely critical, I mean, 21st century skill, to throw another buzzword at you, but that's an absolutely critical future skill for them, because the world is shrinking in so many ways right now, and the internet makes that possible. The globalization of information and commerce and everything else, like, it is truly critical that they understand that and know how to interact in that world. And I think it's more than just that understanding, but that interaction side of, okay, this is how you talk to another person that maybe doesn't have the same experiences as you.
Yeah. And
I think there's plenty of adults that could benefit from that as well.
Yes.
I like that. I like that a lot. You know, and I'm in the same boat. I've always heard about Mystery Skype and then never actually did anything with it, never actually went to the trouble of trying it with my kids. And I think I would love to have done that when I was in a more traditional role. And maybe that'll be one of my goals for this year, is to try that out with someone that's interested. That's cool. I like that. I like that idea of just the global connection. Cool. Well, we're moving right along. I want to go to my third question, and this is probably my personal favorite. Who is, for you as a student, the best teacher you ever had?
So I would say it was my high school English teacher. I went to a really small Catholic school, so I had the same teacher as a freshman, sophomore, junior, senior. That poor woman had like 7 preps. As a teacher now, I'm thinking, my God. But she was not ever someone I thought I would like. You know, I walked in her class as a freshman. She was kind of scary and really stern, and she pushed us really hard. The things we did as freshmen, like we had to do speech. Like, this was her class as a freshman. You have to get up in front of all your classmates and speak 7 times throughout the year. It was horrifying. But it taught me to be more comfortable talking in front of people. But she also, you know, she challenged you. I was always good at writing papers and stuff like that. So, you know, I turned in my paper and it was a C. I'm like, huh, I don't write C papers, you know. And I learned so much from her about how to write and how to engage with reading. And, you know, she was a great teacher. She wasn't a touchy-feely teacher. She wasn't someone I would like go to with my problems or anything like that. But she made me such a better writer. So when I got to college, you know, I'm in these freshman level English classes and people are complaining that we have to read 6 books in a semester and write papers. I'm like, listen, I've been doing that stuff since I was a freshman in high school. Like, I don't know what you're complaining about. But she really kind of taught me how to engage with text. And that sounds so like scholarly, but I really appreciated it so much more than just simply like sitting down and reading a book. The power of words and how they can affect us, and ability to write and get your feelings and, you know, make a nuanced argument, all of those really important skills. So
cool. Yeah, you know, it's interesting how many people I interview for this podcast say that their English teacher was one of their favorites. I don't know why. Maybe it's just me, like, because my English teacher was my favorite, that I just hear that part more. But I feel like many of my guests say that it's their English teacher, which is exactly why I became an English teacher, is because you can do so much in an English class and always relate it back to standards and things like that. So I love that part of it. So. I'm curious about something. You just mentioned something, and something that's been on my mind recently. You went to a private Catholic school, you said, mm-hmm. and you now work in public education.
Yes.
Do you feel like one is better than the other? And does that answer change if it's from a student perspective or a teacher perspective?
Oh, good questions. I had a great education. I will say that hands down. Because it was small, I had, you know, I would say half of the kids I graduated with, all 30 of us, we went to school from kindergarten on. So we had very close relationships, which good and bad, right? Everyone knows everything about you and whatever. You have that opportunity to have deep conversations with your teachers and all of that. So those were all benefits. As a student, the opportunities for us to participate in like electives. So we had to, so ridiculous. We had to take a school bus from our school over to the public school to be able to take like Spanish or drafting or any of those specials. And of course, you know, we have our uniforms and we're over in the public school and all of that. So that was always like stress inducing, especially as a freshman in this huge school. Our school was a hallway. So like, you know, just a lot of things to navigate and you're only there for an hour every day. And so, you know, and we also didn't have as many activities. We had football and basketball and baseball and cheerleading, but there wasn't a ton of other sports. We didn't have a pool or tennis or anything like that. So, you know, there are definitely some pros and cons. Our class was so small. We didn't have that really like cliques and groups. We were all just kind of, yeah, we had friends we were more friendly with, but there wasn't like the jocks and the nerds and all of that stuff. As a teacher, I think, you know, having had life experience, and I went from a very small town to Michigan State University, it's 40,000 people, and I had never met anyone who didn't look like me, didn't practice the same religion as me, didn't come essentially from the same background as me. So that was very eye-opening, and I do think that that's really important, like we already kind of alluded to with the world. So in that sense, I do think that public education provides kids a lot more opportunity to kind of find their space and meet people from all over and have exposure to a whole bunch of different experiences and classes and, you know, really have that chance to kind of dabble. Like, I didn't really get to do that until college when it costs money to take a fun class, you know. So I don't know that one is better than the other. It's hard for me to say. I wish I would have gone to public school because I don't feel that way. But having only taught in public schools, I have seen a lot of value in that. So I don't know. I don't have a good answer for you.
No, that's good. First of all, I think it's interesting that your school offered that busing option. I don't feel like to be able to take electives, like that does give you a little more option than you would have had with only 30 kids in your class. Mm-hmm. You know, you wouldn't have even had that option. So that's nice that you had some of that at least. I don't feel like, you know, at least where we are, that's not really something that happens that I'm aware of. Certainly no one is bused to our school in uniforms to take an elective. That doesn't happen. So that's kind of a nice option, at least for you. And that is one of those things I've always thought about with private schools is they don't have nearly as many of those options. And from the teacher's perspective, I feel like you kind of mentioned already, but trying to imagine doing all four grade levels of English, and that just seems like a nightmare to me. Like that just sounds awful. Trying to do that many preps. I felt like I struggled with one prep half the time, like trying to get innovative, interesting lessons, and then to try to ask them to do not only four preps, but then innovate and do something interesting with all four preps and not do the same thing year after year after year, because then they've already done that. Like, I can't imagine that level of planning happening in my life.
Yeah. And she also did journalism and the yearbook. And, you know, I mean, and also like they don't get paid anywhere near what a public school teacher gets paid. So, and I have a couple of friends who work in private schools, and they are frustrated in different ways than public school teachers are frustrated, but you get a lot more of that parental involvement, some more positive than others. And they do feel like they need to take on all these extra things to kind of supplement their income, which is, you know, part of a larger issue. There's no school teacher thinks they get paid too much. Like, let's be honest, but
I also feel like the whole like private school teachers make less money thing is like a well-kept secret in education. I bet if you ask the parents at a private school, they probably don't know that the teachers there make less money than a public school teacher.
Yeah, because they're paying tuition. Like, well, because clearly all of their tuition dollars just go to teacher salary, right? Like,
right. Yeah. Or at least a significant portion of it, you would think. When I first heard that they don't make as much money, I'm like, I don't know who you are telling me this, but you're an idiot. That can't be true. I'm like, there's no way that's true. And then it's like, oh, wait. Yeah, that is actually true, like across the board. Interesting. Yeah, I don't know. I guess on some level, I don't, as a teacher, see that I would ever want to go to a private school. And money would be one of the reasons, but I feel like that would be the only thing that would drive me there. You know, and you always talk about parental involvement, but, and yes, we know parental involvement is absolutely critical. However, I feel like in my career, some of the best students I've ever had and some of the students I feel like I've made the biggest impact on are ones who had zero parental involvement. So I don't know. I don't know that you can, and maybe it's just a question of why you're in this career. Maybe that's what it is. But for me, that doesn't sound, none of that sounds appealing. Like no part of that is something that I'm going, sign me up. I want to make less money and work harder and do it all for free.
Yeah.
Yay.
And yeah.
No. I don't know.
No, I think there's a perception that private school kids are better in terms of behaviors, and they come from dual income families. And so you have more value on education. But yeah, like for me going into teaching, a lot of it was to make a difference and to impact kids who didn't have those opportunities and experiences at home. So yeah, does it suck when a kid shows up and they're, you know, have an attitude and they're grouchy because they didn't eat? Yeah, that sucks. But if I can be that safe space for them and, you know, give them a stinking granola bar instead of saying, well, you came in past snack time, like who cares? Give them something to eat, for crying out loud. Anyway.
No, I agree. Man, this is an interesting field we work in. I don't know if it's just from the podcast, but also the conversations before that, like there's so many things to think about that I don't think other people outside of education realize all the variables that come into play with what we do. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that's a lot of times where that whole value added comes from is outside of education. They go, well, it doesn't matter if their business isn't making enough money. I just sell them a different product. Or, you know, I always go back to sales because that was what my background was before I ended up in education. But I don't know. I feel like there's this massive equation and it has 97 variables in it. And ultimately the result is student success. Like that's what we're valuing, but we don't even know what any of those variables equal. And every variable is different for every kid. And yet we try to like blame everything on one of those. It's because you didn't work hard enough as a teacher. That's the problem. Like you said, that kid didn't have dinner last night or breakfast this morning. He hasn't eaten in 15 hours and he's starving. So no, he's not going to be able to learn. We know that. Neuroscience tells us you can't learn when you're starving. Like, the hierarchy of needs. But yet we just ignore that and think about this. Or we say it's all that and it can't be affected by the teacher. I don't know. The baby with the bathwater problem, I guess, is maybe what I think of a lot of times. Like, well, that didn't work. So try something completely different and toss everything out.
Right. Yeah. I think part of it is our idea of education as an industrial model that is so outdated, but we haven't changed it. And we just always want to look at that output, that product, and how can we be more efficient? And how can we make it the best product for the cheapest amount of money possible? And yes, capitalism, whatever, but like kids aren't commodities, they're human beings. And I think a lot of the reformers and society want those easy black and white answers. Just tell me what to do. Tell me what to think. You know, tell me what thing to buy. There's 17 choices. I don't know. Someone just tell me what to do so I don't have to figure it out. I think that's part of our challenge in education. Another big paradigm shift that we need.
Man, it's a miracle that any of us are able to function in society with as broken as all this mess is, or that any of our kids are. Like, it's a borderline miracle that anything still functions in this country.
Oh, yeah.
It does. I don't know. Maybe you feel this way too, but sometimes it just feels so daunting. Like, the task feels impossible.
Yes, absolutely. It does. But I always go back to thinking about why I started and that the opportunity to kind of hit that reset button literally every day. I mean, it's there for all of us, but in a school setting, it kind of feels much more enhanced and more natural because, yeah, you have, you know, it's seventh hour and that just really sucked and you get a crappy email from a parent and, you know, now your night's ruined, whatever. But you can wake up the next morning and be like, okay, yesterday was terrible. And what did I learn from that? And how can I make today better? Like, do you think that we have the opportunity to sort of reset? And if you don't, if you're finding yourself like literally every day, like, oh my God, shoot me. I don't want to go to work. I hate all of these kids. I can't deal with this. Like, then maybe it's it's time to find a new career. There's nothing wrong with that. It doesn't mean you're a failure. It doesn't mean that you suck as a teacher. We all change, you know, so can't, I don't know. But I do think that there is a fear of, oh, this sucks and I can't make any money anywhere else. I might as well just stick with this thing, even though I'm miserable. You know, I don't know.
So do you think that that mindset of hitting the reset button, is that something that people just have to be born with? Is that something that's learned? And I guess for your own perspective, were you able to do that your first day of teaching, or I guess second day of teaching, or is that something that you got better at over time?
Yeah, it's definitely something I got better at over time. I remember having my first year of teaching. It's the last day of school before winter break. Now, and of course, you're just, oh, we're watching a movie. It's related to our curriculum, but we're really watching a movie because half the kids are gone, right? So my students.
Not that any teacher would ever do that in a classroom. That's,
no,
you know,
just me.
Hypothetically,
that's
just hypothetically.
Yeah. So I had a student, you know, very well-behaved student most of the time. Whatever, she made a poor choice. Kid went to sit down. She pulled the chair out from under him. He fell, hit his head. I wrote her a detention because that's not okay. And she called her mom halfway through school. I get this, about to walk out of school for my 2 weeks of break after my first year of teaching. I'm like, oh my God, I made it to Christmas, you guys. I think I'm going to survive. And just goes on and on about how she cannot believe that I've given her seventh grade students a detention and she's never done anything wrong in her life and the whole thing. It really bothered me. And I spent a lot of my break questioning, gosh, should I have done that? Should I, you know, whatever. And, but then I learned to just kind of take some of those things with a grain of salt and be confident in my own choices as a professional and being in the situation at the time and, you know, learned experiences and all of that. I do think that there are some people who are better intrinsically at kind of that reset and that positive mindset, but it is really easy to walk into your classroom. It's 91 degrees here today and it's 90% humidity and it's so hot and I'm melting, right? And that's exhausting when you walk into a classroom and have that. And it just can like immediately put you in the wrong mood. But, you know, I think that there are some people who are able to just kind of roll with it. And there are some people who it's really a challenge to like make yourself snap out of it. And I don't know.
It is definitely something learned. I agree you. But I like your way. I like your way of putting it, where it's definitely something you get better at. But maybe some people are just better at it to begin with than others. Like I like that, you know. And I think about it in terms of that whole 50% of teachers quit in the first 5 years thing. That's always that concern I have. And if you look at the educational field as a business model, it costs an absurd amount of money to train an employee. The investment to train an employee is very high. And if we're losing half of them, that's a problem, right? Like just from a money standpoint, if we could work on that, then maybe we'd have more money for things we needed. And, you know, if you try to put that business model on education, but maybe there's some part of that we just genuinely can't teach somebody. Some people just aren't cut out for this field. And I think that's okay. But again, like you said, as long as we don't look at that as that, like, you're a failure. If you can't be a teacher, right, you know, anyone can teach.
Like right.
So, and it just doesn't always work that way.
Yeah.
Tell me, what's the, you know, working with the way you do, and I think this was before the podcast, you know, you talked about how your schools vary a lot in terms of what devices they have, how many devices they have, and things like that. What do you think is maybe the next big wave, or what's the thing that is going to change education next? And it can be technology or not, up to you, but what's the big thing that's going to be to keep an eye out on?
Oh, I think at least for my big goals for this district and the opportunity to kind of have an impact is that creation piece of student creation. And that's kind of twofold. Kids are taking ownership of their learning in that they are excited to share what they're doing because they have some choice in the matter and some flexibility and freedom, but then also looking at how to solve problems and share that with others. I think there are plenty of challenges to choose from in the world, in our district, and students' lives, and giving kids the chance to share their challenges and frustrations and their ideas is something that I'm hoping that more teachers will begin to embrace, and they'll like solutions to those problems. You know, we have a big challenge with hunger in this district. And so how can we not only make people more aware of it, but what are some solutions? Like, can we teach kids how to create community gardens, or I don't know, just kind of throwing ideas out the top of my head, but the opportunity for kids to be problem solvers and creators of technology and show what they've done. Like, hardly any kid runs home and is like, hey, look at this cool worksheet I filled out today. No, but if they make a video, like, hey, mom, pull up my video on YouTube. It's awesome. Check it out. Then that gets kids more excited, and which in turn leads to, again, buzzwords, increased engagement. But then also, you know, we struggle with behavior issues and kids not being in school. So if they know that, hey, I'm going to whoever's class and we are going to work on this, you know, rainwater problem, I'm excited about that. I get to make stuff. I get to create and play. And if I'm not there, I'm going to miss out on all of that. So I want to be there. And if you're working on a problem, you're not going to, you know, this is like old school teaching, right? If your lessons are super engaging, every single one, all the time, you won't have any behavior issues, right? But those are kind of my next big things, I think.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it is so critical that problem-solving component, and it's such a more natural way to learn. It's how we learn, right? It's how we learn as adults. Like, teachers don't just go, yeah, everything's working great, but let's go try student-centered learning. They go, things aren't working great. I should look for something that will work for this problem, and they stumble across student-centered learning and realize that maybe that's a solution. So I think in a lot of ways, those two things are connected. We want students to learn the same mindset and belief system that would fix our paradigm issues in education as a whole. And maybe that's why we're not quite there yet, or we haven't gotten there yet, is because the teachers don't have that mindset yet, and they can't teach their kids to have that mindset until they do. I wonder if, or not wonder, but I feel like that's where my thoughts have been recently, is that's that connection path we need to get to.
Yeah.
Like we talked about, part of that is the PD model. If our PD model is just sit and get about how not to do sit and get, we're never showing the teachers the way to do student-centered learning and investigative learning, problem-solving based, and we're not getting them there yet. So we need to fix if we're in a role, in a coaching role or whatever, maybe we need to fix and model the correct systems first. And hopefully that's the way we can make that paradigm shift happen.
Yeah, no, for sure. I agree wholeheartedly.
So, and I also think, I think conversations like this are so critical. Just like students, I think it's easy for us to fall in this belief that how we work education in our area is the way it works everywhere. And that's not the case all the time. And that's not, we don't all have the same problems necessarily. We may have some of the same causes for problems, but they manifest themselves in different ways. And we may have similar problems, but like you said, we're alike, but different. And that's, I think, really critical that those kinds of conversations keep happening.
Yeah, I agree. And I think more than just the complaining about, because that's super easy to do. Not that there's not some value in sometimes venting, there is. But like, the only way things are going to change and shift is if we not only address, okay, hey, here's all the problems, but now let's also try to come up with some solutions or some ways to change those things. Like, I can complain all the time that I'm fat, right? But if I don't ever change my eating habits or go to the gym, I'm still just going to be fat, right? Like, it's kind of a bad analogy, but you know, like, we can't just complain about the challenges, and it can't just be, well, it must be those students, because has it really been the students for the last 30 years? I don't know, you know, so.
Well, and I think maybe that's the other question about it is education really hasn't ultimately changed that much in the last 30 years. So is it just that this was a systemic problem that we're now seeing the consequences of that whole time? Or is it literally because the world has changed in some fundamental foundational way? Or where do those problems come from? And I think a lot of times we don't have the answer to that question necessarily. And so it's easy for a teacher to go, well, it worked for me when I was a kid, so they should be fine.
Right.
Like, humans haven't changed. Human biology is roughly the same. So something else must have caused a problem. And I think it's easy for teachers to sometimes ignore that and go, well, this generation's just terrible.
Yeah.
And that's obviously not the solution, right? That's not, you know, complaining is not going to fix the issues. So, Cool. Well, you know, Allison, I really appreciate you sitting with me. I thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me. I think we had some pretty good discussions here. I don't know that we fixed any of the world's problems, but we at least talked about it. Maybe gave some solutions, some ideas to try.
No, thank you. It was awesome. I really enjoyed chatting with you and meeting you at ISTE, and I'm glad you reached out and you were able to get this scheduled.
Yeah, absolutely. Which was not easy over the summer.
I know.
So. Although you still appear to be at work.
I am at work. Like, yes, I have to work all summer. So.
Oh, but that's super fun.
23 more days. My husband and I will be in Jamaica for an anniversary, so it's fine.
Oh, that's not too bad.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's a good one. So, all right. Well, again, thanks for sitting with me. I really appreciate it. And, you know, hopefully we'll get a chance to talk again.
Sounds good. Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to the episode. I hope you guys enjoyed it. If you did, then do me a favor and write a review on iTunes or tell a friend about the podcast. I have a new announcement I'm pretty excited about. As of a week ago, Planning Period Podcast is now featured on the VoiceEd.ca radio channel. It gives us a new audience to the show, so if you're listening on VoiceEd now, welcome. And also gives me a space to do some new things. So keep an eye out for announcements on my Twitter and website for some ideas I may be bringing there. Thanks to Stephen Hurley for having my show on the network. And as always, thank you to Kevin McLeod for our intro and close music, Vicious. Check him out at incompetech.com. And you can always connect with me on Twitter. I'm at Brad Schreffler on Twitter. Or check out my website for all the other ways to contact me, and that's bradschreffler.com. I'll see you all in 2 weeks.